Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. COSI has been a fixture of downtown Columbus for more than 50 years. Even as the institution evolves, however, the Center of Science and Industry mission to engage and inspire a love and understanding of science endures. A partnership with the American Museum of Natural History will bring dinosaurs to Columbus later this year. New development in COSI's Franklinton neighborhood will bring an eight acre green space to the property, and these changes will be managed by new leadership. Joining us now is President and CEO of COSI, Frederick Bertley. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ann. Thank you for having me.
Now, do you go by Fred or Frederick?
I go by Frederick.
Okay.
But you can call me anything.
I guess. Well, I think I'll call you Dr. Bertley. You started on January 1st.
That's correct.
So you're still new. And is it honeymoon still?
It's still honeymoon. I'm the new guy, so everybody still likes me so far.
And they're
far,
really nice to you and all that kind of stuff, right?
That's great. But on a more serious note, you know, grew up in Canada, spent a lot of time in the Northeast, and everybody talks about the Midwest as people are just really nice and friendly. And I have to tell you, it has been that to a person. People both at the job and in the city and around the city of Columbus have just been so welcoming. So it's been absolutely fantastic coming. So part honeymoon phase, but I really think that this whole moniker that the Midwest folks are nice is real.
You were at the Franklin Institute in Philadelphia.
That's correct.
Before you came here. You were there for 7 or 8 years?
About eight years and change.
Yeah. And tell us, compare and contrast the Franklin Institute with COSI, because most people are familiar with COSI. I've actually seen the Franklin Institute before, so I know kind of what it's about, but that was a long time ago. So
sure.
Tell us how they're alike and how they're different.
Sure. Well, first of all, the really cool thing about the great science centers in this country, of which there are, you know, anywhere from maybe 20 to 30 great ones, there are, of course, many more. I mean, then they're the top 10, and COSI and Franklin Institute are in the top 10, anywhere from 1 to 8, depending who's ranking them. And what's amazing is, just like people from the Columbus or greatest Columbus area, when you tell them you work at COSI, no matter what you do there, they get so excited and they immediately go into, I remember going to COSI when I was a kid. Now I bring my children. There's that real kind of indelible impact that COSI makes on the people in this area. Franklin Institute's very similar. If you're in Philadelphia and you tell somebody you work at the Franklin Institute, people get super excited. They know what the institution is. They know what it's all about. In terms of what they deliver, they're very similar. Great state-of-the-art exhibits, great programs that happen in the building, great programs that happen outside the building, a lot of families, a lot of kids, great, you know, National Geographic Cinema and Planetarium that COSI has. There's a planetarium and a cinema at the Franklin Institute as well. And so very, very similar. One fundamental difference, however, is the Franklin Institute is much older. It's actually the oldest science center in the country.
Franklin named for the Benjamin Franklin.
Named after Benjamin Franklin, that's correct. And it was created in 1824. And so it's almost 200 years old. So because of that, there's a robust and comprehensive collections and library where they have these great old books like Newton's, one of Newton's three principal physics books are there at the Franklin Institute. They have Benjamin Franklin's original lightning rod. You know, all these really cool things in the collection. So that's one distinguishing feature, but otherwise very similar.
Was Franklin Institute a children's kind of science museum like COSI from the beginning, or when did couldn't have started that way?
It's funny. So that's a great question, Ann, because in the turn of the 19th century, so early 1800s, Philadelphia was the hub of all things technological. Wasn't New York, wasn't Boston, wasn't D.C., wasn't Columbus, and it wasn't the West Coast. And so the folks got together in the city of Philadelphia and created the Franklin Institute for the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. And the charter had three main points. One, to recognize the great inventors – to recognize the great inventions of the day. So the better leather saddle, the better way to plant seeds to yield high growth.
The buggy whip, right?
You know,
exactly.
All those things which we take for granted now. So that was one. Two was to recognize the great people behind them, the people who invented them. And actually, those two things are still present today. The oldest science awards program in the world is the Franklin Institute's awards program. So people like Marie Curie, Albert Einstein, you know, all Thomas Edison, they've all won that medal that started back in 1824. And the third piece, which is really germane to this conversation, the third aspect of the charter was to educate its citizens in the mechanics and the arts. And that was the 200-year-old term for STEM. Today we talk about science, technology, engineering, and math. Well, 200 years ago, they talked about the mechanical arts. And so that's what it's been from the very beginning. The Science Museum, however, was built in 1934. So that period from 1934 to today is very similar to COSI. But
somewhat. I mean, somewhat. But still, 1934 is still pretty young. Did that have something to do with the Depression and Depression-era government programs or anything?
Well, it's funny. So the building was supposed to be built in the shape of a rectangle. It ended up only being in the shape of an L because it was built during the Depression and they literally ran out of money. But it was built because they wanted to do a few things. They wanted to recognize Benjamin Franklin. Right. I mean, he's born in Boston, but he actually did all this great work in Philadelphia. So the federal government, you know, was looking at and people from Philadelphia were looking at, well, how can we do this? So they said, let's create the Franklin Institute. And so that's the national memorial to Benjamin Franklin.
Okay.
So that big statue that you walk into Franklin Institute, it's like Lincoln Memorial, Jefferson, right, et cetera. And so they didn't just want to have the statue. They said Benjamin Franklin really stood for in his writings and in his orations about increasing people's acuity and intelligence around technology and sciences. And so they created a science museum to wrap around Benjamin Franklin.
Talking about science education, my guest, Frederick Bertley. He's the new president and CEO of COSI. We've been talking about the Franklin Institute in Philadelphia. Frederick Bertley has been there for the past 8 years and change, you said, mm-hmm. 7 years. Now, January 1st, he starts his new job with COSI. If you have a question or comment about COSI for Frederick Bertley, he may or may not be able to answer it at this point, but I bet you he'll give it a good try. 614-292-8513. You told the Dispatch that COSI is a great science center. You mentioned already mm-hmm. that the Franklin Institute and COSI rank in the top 10 one way mm-hmm. or another. How do you judge something like a science center? What are the factors?
So, good question. I mean, traditionally, if you Google, you know, top science museums, yeah. or top museums, the way a lot of the rankings go is strictly foot traffic. So, you mentioned AMNH, you know, the American Museum of Natural History in New York City.
Yeah.
They get, I think it's 5 million visitors a year. Franklin Institute COSI will never get 5 million. We're just not in New York. We don't have that kind of foot traffic. So, sometimes they rank them that way. But people who know more about science museums rank the quality of the exhibits, the quality of the programs. And most importantly, they talk about things like the experience, the guest experience. When that family or that youngster or that older person came in, how did they feel by being there? It's very different than an art museum. An art museum, you have fantastic art and it's up on the wall and you look at it and you appreciate it. And then you leave and you say, oh, I got to see the Mona Lisa or what have you, or Gauguin or Chagall. And it's also an experiential, or can be, it should be an experiential process as well. But when you go into a science museum where you have to interact with the exhibits, make you think, challenge your mind, you know, just really push you on the spot, that leaves an indelible mark on you. And if you curate that experience right, the people will leave super excited. They may not think they're Albert Einstein or Marie Curie, but they leave really jazzed and excited about the cool things that science has to offer. And that's what COSI does really well.
You mentioned the American Museum of Natural History. There's a new partnership between COSI and the Museum of Natural History. It's a new concept for COSI, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
What's different? The deal was struck before your time, but what deal is it?
Absolutely. So I am not the architect of the deal, mm-hmm. but hopefully I will be the happy recipient with the rest of the COSI team members for its success. We have a fantastic state-of-the-art science museum, but we don't have a natural history museum in this area. The city of Columbus and Greater Columbus does not have that. And so this was an opportunity to actually leverage what we do really well, which is have state-of-the-art interactive exhibits, but augment that with some really cool content from one of the best natural history museums in the world. And so the partnership will include, as you mentioned, dinosaurs, which I have to tell you, I love the fact that you're smiling. There's not a soul on this planet that does not like dinosaurs. So come to COSI November 2017. You'll be able to see dinosaurs. But we're also going to wrap around the great dinosaur exhibit a bunch of other things from the American Museum of Natural History, different thematic things which can support the dinosaur exhibit.
You know, the Ohio History Connection mm-hmm. has a lot of natural history components to it. Is Ohio going to play a role in this somehow?
That's a good question. So again, I wasn't the architect right. of the deal. I inherited it. But one thing we really want to do at COSI is where possible and as best as possible, where contractually it could be allowed, is to bring in some local regional stuff that can further augment that. So right now, I don't know what exactly is going to be in it, but I'm hoping that's something we can do.
What about the Columbus Historical Society? I really liked that they had a presence at COSI. It seemed real natural and made a lot of sense. What's going to happen with that?
That is being relocated. I know we're keeping some, I believe we're keeping some of the stuff at COSI, but fundamentally, I think that's being relocated off-site somewhere, and I can't remember the address. That's part of my learning curve, so thank you.
You know, your resume is, you know, incredibly impressive. Let me just take a moment here. You were the Senior Vice President for Science and Education at the Franklin Institute in Philadelphia. You have a PhD in immunology from McGill University in Montreal. You were a research fellow in the development of an HIV vaccine at Harvard University Medical School and Children's Hospital in Boston. And you studied how to provide health care in underdeveloped countries of the world. How did you make the transition from all of that to the Franklin Institute in the first place 8 years ago?
It's funny you say that. And hearing you read all that back, I'm like, wow, really? Did I do all that?
Yeah.
But it's interesting. I've come from a background where education is paramount. My parents instilled, I'm the last of four children, my parents instilled the importance of education, education, education. And so, yes, I love science, but I've always loved education. And if you grow up in the scientific spirit and you do your undergrad in science and go on to do a PhD, you start to be part of this kind of ivory tower of academics that, you know, a few other people around the globe have an idea of what you're doing. And that was a huge frustration for me because today, you can't wake up and get through the day without being impacted by science, technology, engineering, and math. When you woke up this morning, if you picked up your phone to look at, you know, what tweets or what emails you missed, you rely on that. The food you eat is genetically modified, whether you like it or not. The clothes we wear, material scientists have worked on it. The cars we drive, the GPS, everything we do today is absolutely directly connected to science, yet a lot of people are comfortable being science illiterate. And so as you navigate this structure of being a research scientist and part of these great hallowed halls of you know, academic institutions, you find yourself not really impacting a wide population to help raise that bar. And so the transition, while it seemed a little weird, was actually really easy because I've always been into education. I've always been into outreach and getting the average person to know stuff. And I want to be clear, Anne, I'm not saying that each of us need to have a PhD in pharmacology or engineering, but just, you know, when we grow up, you're expected to read and write. No one will pressure you to be Maya Angelou or William Shakespeare, but you're expected to read or write. You're also expected to know your times table and count. No one's going to pressure you to be Benjamin Banneker, that African-American mathematician, or Albert Einstein, but you're still expected to learn to count. But for some reason, Anne, it's okay to not know anything about science and say, oh, that stuff's too hard for me. And so the transition was actually easy because working at a Franklin Institute or at a COSI, you get to impact people in the hundreds of thousands and by extension, millions in terms of getting them excited about science.
I was just reading something in Slate about it was referring to that book, The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks, and the HeLa cells, which are like the supercells that have been used for, you know, 50 years now or something like that.
And are still being used.
And are still being used because she had really special cell structure that they were easy to reproduce and they were, you know, you could control.
Yeah. That's a tragic story.
It is a tragic story. And we've talked about it a lot, it seems like, lately. The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks by, I can't think of her first name, but her last name, Scroot, is the author. And when she was interviewing Henrietta's family, one of the ways she got to know them a little bit to go back and find out about how she grew up and where she came from is to talk about what her cells were doing and how they were being used in science around the world. They were like the standard bearer of cells in labs. And she finally realized she wasn't making much of an impact with the family. And she finally, I think she asked, was Henrietta's husband, do you know what a cell is? And he didn't. Yeah. Now, they were very poor, from Baltimore, very, very poor family and historic, you know, tradition or generationally poor, but didn't know what a cell was. And that point was made in the article about science education. Like, how could somebody grow up in the United States of America or even exist here right now and not know what a cell is?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and I mean, I'm glad you brought up that story. It is a tragic story. You know, as a basic science researcher, you mentioned I did research at Harvard. We actually used, like every other lab on the planet, HeLa cells. You know, and the reason
for
why
Henrietta,
you mentioned
H-E
and
L-A
for lax. Mm-hmm. Trust me when I tell you, myself and everybody else had no idea of those origins. We found out slightly before the book came out because we knew that there was some research happening, and we learned, and I in particular studied and dug into it. And it's really tragic because not only did that the husband not know what a cell is, but those cells, when I tell you the billions, it might even be in the order of trillions of research dollars that have been spent literally using those cells, yeah, and all the great discoveries that have positively impacted us
cures
as human
beings,
cures, therapies, specifically by using this woman's cells. And she died poor. Their family died poor. They didn't get a cent. I think there's some restitution lately that they've been working on.
But really minor.
But really minor.
Shockingly minor.
And so you talk about they weren't involved in just general education. Say, here's why your stuff is so cool and interesting. And from financial standpoint, yeah, they weren't supported.
And I apologize. It's Rebecca Skloot is the author. I got that wrong. Mixing up my office history. We're going to continue our conversation. My guest is Frederick Bertley. He's president and CEO of COSCI as of January 1st. We're talking about education, science education, engineering, technology, and what it means and how we can achieve it in places like COSCI and maybe anywhere. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about science and math literacy today. The Oscar-nominated film Hidden Figures has been lauded for telling the stories of three African-American women who played key roles in the early space program. In this scene from the film, NASA mathematician, part of the so-called human computer pool at the time, Catherine Goebel explains her role to a man trying to curry her favor during a church social.
I will have you know, I was the first Negro female student at West Virginia University Graduate School. On any given day, I analyze the manometer levels for air displacement, friction, and velocity, and compute over 10,000 calculations by hand. So yes, they let women do some things at NASA, Mr. Johnson. And it's not because we wear skirts. It's because we wear glasses.
Not without a sense of humor. Still with us is President and CEO of COSCI, Frederick Bertley. What a great opportunity. Hidden Figures is an amazing story. Lots of people just shake their heads and wonder, why didn't we know about these women before? There are two forms of discrimination in the story, racism mm-hmm. and sexism. And although the film considers how science benefited people despite those isms, I couldn't help but wonder what it's lost over time because of those.
You know, and I mean, it being Black History Month, what perfect timing for that kind of film to drop. But I think the problem is even more complex than that. I mean, absolutely sexism and racism. But, you know, it's interesting what's really going on. We talked about people not really knowing much about science. Mm-hmm. Well, and you can do this experiment. Go out, find a crowd of 100 people and ask them, think of a scientist, tell me a scientist, and what's the first person they're going to tell you? Albert Einstein.
Yeah.
They do this all the time. And then if you're speaking to women or you ask a group of men and women, name me a woman scientist, who do they name?
Madame Curie.
Marie Curie.
Marie
Curie, Madame Curie, yeah. And mm-hmm. and if it's Black History Month and you're speaking to a group of African Americans, you say, name me a scientist, they start saying there's that peanut guy, George Washington Carver. This is unbelievable. I've given this lecture coast to coast through Canada, Europe. You get the same three people all the time. And so general society doesn't know about scientists in general. And it's, you know, now they might know, okay, Neil deGrasse Tyson, he kind of exists because he's a famous guy. And there's this weird guy. If you ask him to name you a living scientist, they scratch their head and they think there's this weird guy in a wheelchair. Stephen Hawking's a physicist. But we don't know scientists. So, A, we absolutely didn't know these great, phenomenal women working for NASA. That's unbelievable, and that message should get out. Two, they were African American. That's unbelievable. That message should get out. But in general, we don't know about scientists. And so they got caught up in the, you know about John Glenn, which you should, but you don't know about the scientists who put John Glenn, white or black, male or female. And that's just part of what I wish to kind of change for the society, that they're working on stuff that's changing our lives and impacting us in great ways.
You know, and even still, when you know about John Glenn, you don't know he was an astrophysicist.
That's exactly
it's more
right.
Wow that he was an astronaut, and that is a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
But the whole idea that he was an astrophysicist was
gets
just
lost.
Pushed to the sidelines. Yeah. So what is that? What's going
it's,
on?
It is. It gets back to my theories. It gets back to this. And scientists are to blame. They live in these ivory towers. They like to make things sound so complex. They come up with a jargon that nobody else can understand except for their peers. And by doing that, they ostracize them from the rest of society. So if you have the choice of finding out about John Glenn's astrophysicist PhD or what was it like to go up in space, right? We're all going to say, what was it like to go up in space? Because that stuff's too complex. And that's part of the problem. You know, I mean, I can give you a real – go ahead.
Go, no, you go ahead.
I mean, I can give you a real example. If you ask most people, do they like math? They don't like math. If you walk into a fourth grade classroom, how many of y'all like math? One hand might go out of 30 students. Why don't you like math? Oh, it's too hard. It's scary. Yet if you ask them, how many of y'all want a dollar? Every hand will go up. If you say, how many of y'all want $10 right now? Both hands go up to get excited. How about $100? Ask them if they want $1,000. They will jump out their chairs and they'll be so excited. Dr. B, you're going to give me $1,000. Well, they understand logarithmic growth and exponential growth base 10. That's something that if you wrote f of x is equal to log x base 10 on a board, they would run scared. But they fully understand what is possibly a complex math thing because it was presented differently.
You know, that scary thing, I wanted to get to that. You said, oh, they don't like it because it's scary. What are they scared of? And does that go to the ivory tower thing where they're scared of looking like a failure if they don't get things right? Because I know a lot of kids and a lot of people think if they don't get something right or if they're not good at it, that they shouldn't study it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And
that
I think
you have to be, you know, the top person. You have to be the golden boy or the golden girl. And then you get to move into science and math. Whereas you made the point, everybody needs expected to read and write.
Absolutely. I mean, I think you're spot on. I think part of the problem is how we train our young, how we are in society, where we push the science forward like you have to have the exact right answer. And the joke about that, the comedy of errors here, is science actually happens by constantly asking questions and getting wrong answers and moving the ball
right.
forward.
So how did that happen?
You know, I think it's a combination of when you hoard the information and you rise that into that ivory tower of academia, for instance, and we're talking science here, that, well, you feel you're more special because you understand it instead of sharing how important this information is.
Do scientists do that consciously? Necessarily?
You know, scientists are interesting. I mean, this is another reason why I love my job, because I straddle both things. I am a scientist, but I'm an educator. I like being out in the community. I like meeting people. I like being warm and fuzzy. That's just not a typical scientist. The typical scientist, he or she is often brilliant, but as the young lady said in the movie, it's not because we wear skirts, it's because we wear glasses. I mean, she was being cute, but it's really the point that often they're nerdy, they're a little weird, they're not very social, and they're good at their numbers or they're good at their experiments, and that's just where they want to be. And so they're not front and center. That's why, again, back to John Glenn, what was sexy wasn't that he was an astrophysicist, but that he was a man who went up in space.
So were you irritating to people as you were moving up through the ranks because you're naturally effusive and comfortable in social situations?
I mean, I'm glad you brought that up. I mean, I hope I wasn't irritating.
Well, I was kind of doing tongue-in-cheek, but...
Yeah, I mean, it's just, you know, the best... You remember that your best teacher. The best teachers are the teachers who connected with you. If you're a teacher or a professor, you're trying to get a point across, I don't care what the content is. If that boy or girl in front of you is disconnected or can't resonate or relate to you, game over. Whereas if they feel a bond or they feel a warmness or they feel connected to you, their minds will open and they'll take it all in. And that's why I've tried to stratify that basic science bench research out in the public community.
I wonder how much of this failure to pass on the science passion has to do with the fact that women have been discouraged one way or another historically from going into the sciences or math, and women make up and have for a long time the largest number of teachers.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And it's a big problem. I mean, even today, it's still a big problem. Women in the life sciences now, are getting bachelor's degrees roughly the same as males, so roughly 50-50. When you start going up to PhDs, what they call, and this is not my word, but what they call the soft sciences, like psychology, you'll get women getting 60% of the doctorates mm-hmm. versus 40% male. When you start going to biology, you get about 50-50, but then you go to physics, engineering, computer science, it drops down to 20s and sometimes into 10s. So while much has been gained in the last 50 years in terms of getting more women into science, there are still some serious obstacles that need to
Why do they make it so tough?
You know, I think it gets back to what you said, the whole idea of, oh, it's okay to be a teacher, because I think through history, being a teacher was kind of like being a parent. And so you're a mom, you're staying at home with the kids.
That was more acceptable.
Well, you're a teacher, you'll be in the classroom, whereas if you want to be an engineer or a doctor, you have to be a man out there. And so I think some of that has legacied into this. But it's a complex issue that we have to just keep having movies like Hidden Figures and having conversations like these to get girls to think they can do this stuff too.
Does the science community... I mean, they can acknowledge, you can look at the numbers and see the graduation rates. And then beyond the graduation rates, how many people are actually employed in the fields? That's mm-hmm. There's a huge drop off at that point.
Yep.
But do people inside the ivory towers and inside the science community see the problems with this?
You know, I think the administrators try to. So deans, chairs of departments, and presidents and provosts are really seeing that. I think most scientists are just doing what they're doing.
Yeah.
Most scientists are trying to fight to get that very competitive next National Science Foundation grant or NIH grant. You know, they're not worrying about all these social mores and all these other issues. But I think administratively, universities across the board and even, you know, research centers that aren't associated with universities, they're starting to get that. That's why you're seeing all these programs to try to diversify the incoming pool, provide opportunities for women, provide opportunities for black and brown populations. On a fair scale, they still have to be qualified, of course, to get through. But really keep an eye out for making sure that you have as diverse a pool as possible, because the ideas to solve the grand challenges of the world are going to come from a diverse group of people.
For a long time, solving these great challenges of the world came from in the United States government. You know, NASA was government funded. The mm-hmm. space program was by and for the government. Mm-hmm. Now it's branching out very, very quickly into private enterprise and mm-hmm. being commercialized. There's a big contest going on for who's going to, you mm-hmm. know, land on Mars first and that kind of a thing. And I think of, like, say, the book The Rocket Boys about, you know, those scientists back in the day and in Appalachia, down in Appalachia, what they achieved. And they were motivated because there was so much excitement around the space program.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering what motivates people today.
Yeah, I think, I mean, part of NASA's success and NASA was right on spot for its time. You know, it came from Kennedy's, you know, wish to get somebody on the moon. I mean, when that Sputnik in 57, I think it was, when the Russians sent up Sputnik, that was the shot heard around the world that galvanized Americans to be like, wow, we got to get on top. And you heard it from the president first, and that distilled down. And so NASA had all the funding they need and ran like the wind, recruited the top scientists and did a good job. But that's kind of an exception. The way things get invented and discovered, whether it's for-profit stuff, whether it's cancer therapies, whether it's, you know, whatever engineering phenomenon, the cell phone, it's by free enterprise. That's the competition. That's why your cell phones, you know, I mean, just think 10 years ago what a cell phone was like. If cell phones were produced by government entities, we'd still be pulling that old cell phone in your wagon because it would be huge. It wouldn't be functional. But now you got an iPhone or a Samsung. I mean, the technology changes so quickly, and that's because of the competition of free enterprise. And so you're seeing it, as you said, with SpaceX and now going possibly trying to have a human mission to Mars. These are private entities that are doing this. They're faster. They're more agile. They don't have red tape. They don't have 15,000 documents that need to be signed off by 14,000 people that don't have a clue what's in them. And so they're able to be much quicker and move faster.
Are you frustrated by the strain of anti-intellectualism, anti-science, science deniers?
Well, so
in your brain, what do you know about them? Everything from people who think humans roam the earth with dinosaurs to climate change skeptics, that kind of a thing.
I mean, those are great questions. And I mean, again,
that's an American phenomenon. That's not the way it is around the world.
The United States, to be fair, the United States is one of the least science literate countries and a country that's very happy with science skepticism and I just want to say that for the skeptics out there, they need to understand that science is not a fact. Science is a process of asking questions and getting information that's the data to analyze to give you your best possible, you know, thought, fact-ish, etc. For example, 6,000 years ago or 4,000 years ago, all the scientists of the day thought the world was flat. That was a fact back then. But the issue wasn't, was it flat or not? The issue was, do scientists keep challenging that question, keep challenging what's going on? And that's what they did. And Copernicus figured out, wait a minute, it's round, et cetera, et cetera. And that's the beauty of science. It's not that it's right or wrong. The process inherently isn't wrong. You're asking a question and you want to verify it with as much information as you can have. Now, you talk about the science deniers. There are real consequences to that phenomenon in this country. For example, multi-drug resistant bacteria, right? Well, when you and I go to the doctor, and if the doctor says you're sick, sometimes they say, and this has happened to me, maybe this has happened to you, Anne. They may say, you know, you have I think you have a viral infection. Okay. And then they give you a prescription for an antibiotic. And we do, like most people, we go to the pharmacy, we can barely read the writing, we hand in the prescription, and we get the pills and we take the pills. And that's a medical doctor. Now, I'm not saying everybody should question the heck out of everybody, but that medical doctor needs to explain to you why, if he or she is telling you they think you have a viral infection, giving you a drug that's an antibiotic, which means it's antibacterial, has no use against the virus. I mean, people talk about it as accidental support use. Overall, it's got no impact there. Yet they're giving it to you. And now in hospitals around this country, we have the things they call superbugs. These are bacteria that are resistant to 10 and 15 different strains of antibacterial products we have. And they're killing people. And so science literacy should play a role with that. Overprescription has to do with doctors and nurses just really not paying attention to the science behind what they're doing. You look at something like vaccines. There was a whole anti-vaccine movement, this whole movement about vaccines. There still is. Measles causes autism, et cetera, despite the data out there that's proved to the contrary. Here's the reality. The measles vaccine will protect you from measles. Right now in the United States of America, every year there are kids who die from measles. Now, if you're a parent and your child died from a preventable disease, that's a problem. And so there's nothing wrong with challenging. I'm all about challenge the system. But look and analyze the data. And you know, when you see how many millions of people, tens, probably hundreds of millions of people around the world have been saved through vaccines, I mean, it's just bizarre. And genetically modified foods, I mean, whether you like, unless you shop religiously at Trader Joe's or Whole Foods, and I'm just not a commercial for them, but if you shop anywhere else, the bulk of what we eat is genetically modified. And I don't just mean, you know, a fruit. I'm talking about your cornflakes, you know, your pasta sauce in the bottle. That has all genetically modified stuff in there. I'm not saying it's good or bad. I'm indifferent at this point, but we just need to have some understanding around that. Now, I do give a pass for the dinosaurs and the humans because I grew up in the late 70s, early 80s, and I'm a huge Hanna-Barbera fan. And my favorite cartoon was Fred Flintstones. And as a kid, Fred would go to work, and what did he do? And he sat on the back of a dinosaur in the quarry.
Dino
the dinosaur dog. So, you know, I got a little confused. But aside from that, yeah, dinosaurs kind of predated
it's us. Funny because even though I watched the same cartoons, you always knew it was just a cartoon. Yeah. But there's museums erected to suggest that humans roamed the earth with dinosaurs.
And that's one thing that I look forward to continuing the tradition at COSCI, to have open dialogue, show the data, let people see here's the data, you know, make your own decision.
We're talking about science education today with Frederick Bertley. He is president and CEO of COSCI. He's been on the job since January 1st. If you have a question or comment for him, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You could email us at allsides@wosu.org or check out our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking science education this hour. That includes math and engineering and the arts. Still with us is President and CEO of COSAI, Frederick Bertley. Frederick Bertley took over at COSAI on January 1st. He's brand new to the job. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. I want to turn back to COSAI a little bit. Mm-hmm. We've got a question from Sarah on Facebook, and I have a few questions of my own. Sarah asks, we're a very linguistically diverse community in Ohio now, but COSAI doesn't reach a lot of those different language speakers. What do you think?
First of all, Sarah, thank you very much for that question. You're spot on. I mean, COSAI and other institutions like us, whether you're an art museum in Columbus, we really have to look at the population to whom we serve and make sure all things are accessible. So we actually have a lot of programs, and we're developing more, where we can ensure that our outreach is much more comprehensive. So we want to translate programs into other languages. We want to also ensure if you have disabilities that we do a good job to some extent, but we can do more to make sure our entire building is accessible regardless of how your mobility is, and things like deafness and blindness as well. And so the good news is, Sarah, we have some of these programs in the pipeline and we're working on them, but I really appreciate your point. It has to be as accessible for everybody as possible.
You've said that COSAI can reach a bigger audience. You know, you said that COSAI, you know, and the Franklin Institute in Philadelphia will never get the $5 million that the Museum of Natural History gets in New York. But what are you shooting for? What do you mean?
So I'm shooting for two things. I'm shooting for an increase in attendance, and we'll figure out whatever that means in the next coming years. But also, what's going to fill that increased attendance is reaching to a more diverse audience. I can tell you in Philadelphia, you know, Philadelphia is 48% or 47% African American, 38% Caucasian, you know, 10% Latino, et cetera. But you'd go to the Franklin Institute, it was all white. And it's not because, you know, Latino population and African-Americans aren't interested in that. It just had that, oh, that's for them kind of thing. Now, COSAI is a little different, doesn't have that rigid kind of veneer. But still, just per Sarah's point, just making sure we have enough programmatic stuff that's of interest to all folks, not just race and gender, but also stage of life. We have a new program called COSAI After Dark that really caters to the 21-year-old to 40-year-old audience. And on any given night, we'll get anywhere from 800 to 1,400 people who are 21 to 40 years old at COSAI in the evening from like 7 to 10. Of course, selling beer and wine and alcohol helps, mm-hmm. but it's really to make people understand that, hey, COSAI is not just for families with little kids, but it's for everybody, you know? So that's in the building. Then outside in the community, we want to extend these branches and these tethers into these diverse communities and bring COSAI programmatic elements there where they, and we like to say, where they live, learn, and lounge. Because if you're trying to impact that Latino community or African American community or Girl Scout troop or what have you, when you do it where they're used to being and when you do it where they're comfortable, they have a much easier chance of thinking, wow, this can really be for me. Whereas we want you to come back to COSAI and buy a ticket and come to the exhibits. But sometimes you might think, oh, well, that was at COSAI. I can't really be that scientist on my own. No, yes, you can. And COSAI is going to help you get you there.
But COSAI isn't free.
COSAI isn't free, but we do have programs which help underserved populations. So we have programs. We have a program called Access, which hits everything between based on your income, based on your capacity to pay, et cetera. So we do have programs where we don't want a ticket to be a barrier to you appreciating what we try to bring to you.
Randy in Delaware, you're on the air. Hi, Randy.
Hi, I'm a retired teacher, 33 years in the math classroom, and I just loved what he had to say about the idea that, you know, presenting it, it makes a lot of difference into how well students perceive they understand it. You know, I did something even much less than logs, you know, in a high school classroom, you know, I'd say, what's 25 times 17? And the kids would look at me like, you know, you're crazy. I've got to get my calculator, you know, and I say, well, okay, if you got 17 quarters, how much money do you have?
And
even the slowest student would, you know, come up with $4.25.
There you go.
It's great. I love it.
Well, Randy, thank you very much for your spirit. Thank you for your dedication to 30 years of being a math teacher. Really appreciate that. Well, let me know when you're coming to COSAI. I'd love to host you. I'm easy to find.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Randy. Elizabeth in Columbus, you're on the air with Frederick Burtley, the president and CEO of COSI. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was a science teacher, and I also taught adult ed, which included science and math, both. And now I work in educational psychology. And so I was wondering what COSI does to work with teachers, because I've noticed that especially for elementary school teachers, they tend to have a lot of anxiety when teaching math and science because they're not specifically trained in teaching those subjects during their teacher education program. And I've noticed, like, my eighth grade students had no idea that the point of science was to learn new things. They thought it was just memorizing facts. And my adult students had kind of the same impression. And
sure.
So I was wondering what COSI does to work with teachers to help them teach science as a dynamic process instead of a list of facts to be memorized.
That's a great, great question. And again, just like a previous caller, Randy, you know, thank you so much for your dedication. And you've taught at all kinds of different levels, which is great. In my previous work at the Franklin Institute, we did a lot of teacher professional development, everything from pre-K to high school. And so I have a lot of experience doing that. COSI does some, but not as much professional development. I'm learning the landscape here in Columbus. And in my initial research, I was made to understand that a lot of teacher professional development happens either through the school districts or through other organizations. But that's something that definitely I want to see COSI doing. And one of the reasons why is the educators at COSI and that landscape just offers you a different type of environment to really impact the audience. So teachers who are traditionally used to being in the classroom and rigid structured classroom, there's so many elements from an informal science center, an informal science environment that can be bled into a teacher and therefore bleed into the teacher's landscape of the classroom that can really get kids to see and approach science, to your point, differently than just memorizing and regurgitating facts. So we will be offering more. I can't tell you exactly what those are until I continue to get my feet wet. But teacher professional development is huge, and science centers can do what other institutions can't just because we're so flexible with how we can teach and excite people about science.
Right. I mean, teachers want to have fun too.
Absolutely. That's right. That's exactly right.
Email from Kim says, I am pursuing a graduate degree in a STEM field. The good news is that the faculty and student body are majority female. Med school and dental school admissions are trending toward women, too. At OSU, more than half of the Med 1 class is female, for example. While the work is far from done, there is genuine progress.
Amen.
Thank
Absolutely.
You, Kim. And Elizabeth, thank you for your call. Appreciate that. How much goes on behind the scenes between science museums across the country? We talk about the traveling exhibits. I mean, there must be some pretty strong consortium going on there for that kind of stuff.
Absolutely. In fact, one of the reasons why I'm here, aside from what's happening at the Scioto Peninsula, what I like to call the COSI Peninsula, we can talk about that later. But one of the reasons why I'm here is I came to Columbus specifically for a conference called AZTEC, which stands for the Association for Science and Technology Centers. It's the world's largest science museum conference and organization. And each year the conference goes in another city, most often the U.S., but sometimes outside the U.S. And so in 2012, it was here in the city of Columbus, and COSI, being the major science museum here, hosted it. And I'll never forget it. I came and, I was so impressed with COSI. I mean, the building is just so interesting, from an architectural gem to a really cool place inside. B, the team members or staff there were absolutely phenomenal. They were doing some things that were super excited. And as somebody that goes to this conference annually, that was one of the warmest, best conference experiences I had. So to your point, science museums are part of different consortium, and we try to work together here and there when we can. For example, building exhibits. Sometimes you'll collaborate with other science museums so you can offset the cost of the construction exhibit, and then it can travel to each exhibit. Programmatically, sometimes we partner with other institutions to learn what they did well. For example, we're working on things like the Science Festival. We're going to leverage what my previous institution and other places did around the country to bring that here to Columbus. How do you run a really nice science festival? So there is a collaborative spirit, and I think that just comes from the landscape of people who work at science museums are just fun, agreeable, and they just want to do good stuff. So it's not that uber competitive kind of for-profit mentality.
Let's talk about that 7 acres. There's going to be 7 acres of green space. Where's that coming from, and what are you going to do with it?
Yeah, so the west side of COSI, which faces the water, there's that development that's beautiful, that park space there. On the east side is where we have currently a big hole in the ground. Prior to that, that's where the parking was. So the parking was kind of in the front of the building. So what they've done is they're consolidating all that parking and putting it underground. And so you'll have about 6 floors or however many floors of underground parking.
All of it's going to be underground parking.
About 650 spots or so underground parking.
Okay.
And above ground or at ground level is going to be this beautifully greener, manicured, wonderful space to hopefully do some really cool programmatic initiatives.
Like what?
Like everything from a science festival. I mean, imagine having tens of thousands of people.
I was going to ask you about that because I know you started one in Philadelphia.
Absolutely, yeah. Co-founded in Philadelphia.
Yeah.
Great experiment. Wonderful program. Looking forward to bringing that here. So you can have things like the science festival, but you could also have pop-up mini science exhibit type stuff. So people who are coming who want to just hang out on this beautiful park area can just not sit and just do a picnic, but maybe can sit and do a picnic and have some fun, as you said, some fun science programming to heighten their experience.
Email from Elisa. I am an adult and I am looking forward to a visit. I have to confess I have not visited COSAI in a long time, but I want to have a greater appreciation for the role science plays in my everyday life. What do you recommend I see and do when I visit? So it can be exhausting to go there and feel like you have to see everything at once. So Elisa,
thank you very much for that question. The good news is there is so much stuff to do at COSAI that you can't miss. I would suggest that you, if you're coming with friends and family, plan a 2-day visit. You know, that way you can divide up what you want to do. But, it depends who you come with. If you come with little kids, you got to go to our little kids space. I mean, that's just a phenomenal, really great hands-on experience for the younger kids. They love it. You know, if you're coming by yourself, you might want to experience our planetarium shows. Those are this planetarium state of the art for this country and has a great suite of programmatic things for you to pick from. So it really depends what you want to do. But there's no problem coming twice or three times in the same year. So hopefully I'll see you soon.
Let's see. Sue in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Sue.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just, mostly a comment. I want to say thank you. I am a woman of a certain age. I'm in my 50s. And my first experience at COSAI was as a Brownie and then a Girl Scout. We would come in and do overnight trips. At least once a year. And I look forward to those. I grew up in rural Southern Ohio. So, it was such a phenomenal experience. I remember going into the science lab late at night, 11 o'clock at night, and working with scientists and, cracking open an egg and learning about the different parts of an egg. And I want you to know that 40 odd years later, every single time I crack an egg open, I think of COSAI.
That is terrific. First, I really appreciate that history. And I got to tell you, you'll be pleased to know that I think this coming October 2017, is the National Girl Scouts conference.
Uh-huh.
And we're going to have 12,000 Girl Scouts descend on the city of Columbus. And COSAI will be hosting a really cool overnight experience, not dissimilar from what you just talked about. And we still do that, by the way, regularly. We have some Girl Scout troops who come in. But thank you for that. And you're really speaking to the point of when you have that experience, that egg cracking experience late at night, you're just never going to forget that. And I love the fact that you're able to bring that up. And that's what we try to do at COSAI. And that's what we try to do at science centers across the country. So please come back. When you come back, please shoot me an email. I'd love to meet you and tell you about the great things we're doing.
Sue, thank you so much for the call. I wanted to go back to the Philadelphia Science Festival. What exactly is it?
Yeah, so myself and a colleague at the Franklin Institute, Steve Snyder, who's no longer there, he's at the Reuben Fleet Science Center in San Diego. We wrote a National Science Foundation grant. We co-wrote a National Science Foundation grant to get funding to put on a science festival. Now, this was 8 years ago. There were a couple little science festivals happening in the country, but they weren't major. We did end up receiving funding from the National Science Foundation. Four groups got funded: MIT in Cambridge, University of California, San Diego, University of California, Santa Barbara. We were the only non-university group to get funding. And we didn't call it the Franklin Institute Science Festival. We called it the Philadelphia Science Festival because we really wanted to engage the whole city. And in a nutshell, Anne, it's like I said, we've run it for 6 years now. This is our seventh year. We put on about 100 events in a 9-day period. Okay, and of the 100 events, 90 of them are free. And these are events, you know, they could be the science of a bear, and you do a bear pub crawl, but you're learning about all the science. The science of food, working with a lot of food scientists understanding food. You know, everything from aeronautics to vaccines to agriculture. We work with, basically, we have 200 100 partners. Every institution of higher learning, every for-profit company, every nonprofit company, religious organizations, you name it, we put all these folks together. And the key to the success was that each group had to work collaboratively with another group to put on the programmatic experience.
And you think we can do this in Columbus?
I know we can do this in Columbus. I mean, what's one of the – I mentioned, why did I come here? Partnership, partnership, partnership. People at Columbus are in Columbus are serious about working together, and that's what it takes to put on a science festival.
Well, Frederick Bertley, thank you so much for joining us today to talk about it. I hope you'll come back again soon.
Anytime you invite me, Anne. Thanks for having me on today.
Frederick Bertley, he is the president and CEO of COSI. Brand new, just started the job on January 1st. Thanks for listening today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.